AntiWar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton, and this is AntiWar Radio. Well, you go to war with the army you have, and ours obviously isn't good enough for benevolent global hegemony. Well, they're working on it, and here to tell us about the military's plans for the future and their weapon systems is Frieda Berrigan. She's the Senior Research Associate at the World Policy Institute, and she's on the National Committee of the War Resisters League. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on, and my boss, Eric Garris at AntiWar.com, was really excited to find out that you're the daughter of Phil Berrigan, who was on the FBI's most wanted list for actions against the Vietnam War. You must be so proud.
Yes, I am.
And what exactly was it that he was on the FBI's most wanted list for?
Well, Phil Berrigan and his brother Dan Berrigan and a number of other people during the Vietnam War did a series of draft board raids where they went into draft board offices and took out the files of young men. At that point, it was exclusively young men who were about to be sent over to Vietnam, and they took the files out of the office, first in Baltimore as part of the Baltimore 4, and then the Catonsville 9 a few years later, and then it kicked off a whole series of actions of destroying the draft records of men who were about to be sent to Vietnam. And they did that, my father and my uncle did that as Catholic priests. And that was significant at that point, and it, as I said, kicked off a whole series of these kind of actions that effectively destroyed thousands and thousands of records, and at the same time provided a platform from which to talk about the Vietnam War and how wrong it was, and they went to prison repeatedly for that.
And particularly the evil of conscription, which is really nothing but public slavery.
Right, yeah. So throughout his life, my dad would meet people whose records he had destroyed, and they would sort of express a sense of gratitude and a real feeling that their lives had been saved because they had not been sent to Vietnam.
Wow.
And then throughout the 70s, 80s, 90s, my dad and many other people were part of what's called the Plowshares Movement, and they went on to military installations and effectively carried out the mandate from the Gospel of, or from the prophet Isaiah, the prophet Micah, to beat swords into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks, turning weapons of mass destruction symbolically into tools that enhance and enrich life, farming implements. So they did this whole series of actions. There have been more than 100 what are called plowshares actions. Both my dad and my uncle were involved in the first, which was in 1980, the Plowshares 8. And then things just continued from there.
Wow, that's very interesting. I'd like to go back and read all about that. Eric said he's always wondered from your last name whether you were related, and he was really happy to know that you are, in fact, Phil's daughter.
Yeah.
All right, now, so let's get to your recent article here that you wrote for Tom Dispatch that we also ran at antiwar.com, Raptors, Robots, and Rods from God. It sounds kind of scary, just in the title. Sounds like a Terminator movie or something. And what this is basically about is all the future weapon systems that the various branches of the military and their technical geniuses have dreamed up for the future, right?
Right, yeah. So the Raptor is a new fighter plane, and Rods of God are this kooky idea that that we can control warfares of the future from space. It's this system that is at this point just a bunch of drawings and computer simulations.
Geez, I guess we can be thankful for that.
Well, yeah. I mean, what's interesting was looking through and preparing for this article, so many of these systems, whether it's missile defense, ballistic missile defense, or some of these high-tech fighter planes and bomber planes and warships of the future, that they're not that they're not constructed and they can't do what they purport to do, and yet millions and millions and coming up on billions of dollars, certainly in the case of missile defense, we've spent more than $200 billion on pursuing this kind of technology in the last couple decades, that it's just money that's being put into a giant hole, really, the hole of the military-industrial complex. And that would be bad enough, right, like that we're wasting billions of dollars at a time when there are so many pressing human needs that need to be addressed. But then there's also the geopolitical impact of all of this and what other countries do in response to what the United States is planning to do.
Mm-hmm.
So we can draw a straight line between the United States' new nuclear research and development, the $6 billion or so dollars we're spending on nuclear weapons research and technology right now, and the plans of Iran, of Pakistan, of North Korea, perhaps of the Chinese further developments of nuclear technology, other countries that are secretly pursuing nuclear technology. There's a cause and effect there that's
right.
Very, very clear.
Even the Russians, too, right, are working on, I guess I read that they're working on mirrored missiles that the lasers will bounce off of. They built a super laser onto a 747 that's supposed to shoot down ICBMs on takeoff, and the Russians are working on just reflecting the laser away.
Right, yeah, so everybody's got their own sort of scheme for the future.
Well, and we can basically really combine those two topics to start here, the Star Wars and the escalation, the arms race that comes from it. Just this week we had China shoot an old satellite in space just to prove they could, and they said, their spokespeople came out and said that the reason they did it was to draw attention to the fact that we ought to have a global treaty banning such things.
Right. China has been working for the last number of years, I think about 5 years, pushing on this treaty. They've gotten no response from the United States. They've gotten no movement on all of this. And they are the country that, that the United States is watching most closely. They're a very large and powerful country, large and powerful military. Many of our war plans of the future involve China in one way or another. Of course, they're also a huge economic power. They sent us this engraved invitation for important treaties for the future. We ignored them completely. We continued to saber rattle and threaten China. And this was the only way in which they felt that they could get some movement on this. Unfortunately, the response from the Bush administration has been, to go back to our own drawing boards, to go back to our own plans and systems and satellites and lasers and weapons, and to rely on technological solutions to these sorts of problems rather than diplomatic and multilateral solutions that we can build along our mutual interests in not seeing the future completely destroyed. So we don't know how this new development will pan out, but the silence on the U.S. side and the speculation has been deafening.
Now, I have to say, I really wish that my government wouldn't go around the world provoking fights with everybody, but as it is, they do exist, and really their number one job, their only job is national defense, and I guess I kind of like the idea of my government shooting anti-missile missiles at any incoming warheads and blowing them up over the ocean rather than letting them get to L.A. if it comes down to that. Is it simply that it's so expensive and unworkable that just forget about it no matter how good my intentions are here?
Well, yeah, I think here in the United States we have an extraordinary ability to believe in technology, right? That there's a technological solution to every problem.
Absolutely. This conversation.
Right, exactly. And in an ideal world, in a perfect world, missile defense would actually create a shield over this country. And if it could do that, by spending a reasonable amount of money, whatever a reasonable amount of money is, maybe it would be technology that was worth pursuing. If there were actually missiles out there that could hit us and that were threatening to hit us. And that was a reasonable threat from which we needed to defend ourselves.
But really the only countries that could deliver nuclear bombs here would be either our allies in Europe or Russia and China.
That's right. That's right. So we have all these other nightmare scenarios, North Korea, Iran, an Islamic State in Pakistan. Those are all very far off, very remote, and very preventable. And so are the threats coming from Russia, certainly. We know exactly what we need to do to keep a nuclear missile coming from Russia to hit us. China, as we've already been discussing, wants to pursue a different way. So there are all these intermediate steps that we can take to keep these threats from developing, to keep them from becoming imminent. Mm-hmm. And then there's the fact that the technology just is never going to work.
Yeah, they failed over and over again to shoot down incoming missiles, haven't they?
Exactly. They failed over and over again. They failed so often and so embarrassingly that they no longer make public the results of the tests. And the tests, I mean, it's a misnomer to even call them tests. They are highly scripted is the language that they use. And that means that basically they're set up so that they won't fail, that they're not tests at all, that they're PR, they're sort of propaganda exercises.
Right, and then they fail anyway.
That's right, and then they fail anyway.
Now, you said earlier that America's wasted $200 billion on this project since the 1980s. Is that all? I guess I would have thought it was even more than that.
Well, that's a good question. The $200 billion comes from the Congressional Budget Office. So it's a nice, round, solid number that's backed up by, you know, basically an arm of the government. You could argue and sort of add into those costs a lot of other things, and it could become a much larger number.
Well, and you say it's $9.4 billion just for fiscal 2007.
That's right. Since President Bush has come into office and sort of made ballistic missile defense one of the pillars of his administration, pretty quietly, we have seen a large upswing in spending on missile defense programs. And in fact, moving forward on deploying those few aspects of the system that do work or that have been proven to work in these highly scripted tests. So he's moving forward with it very, very quickly, despite the fact that it will never work. And there are many different reasons for that. I think primarily among them is this idea that missile defense is not a defensive system at all. In fact, it's an offensive system.
It's to make it safe for us to be more belligerent.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. You put your finger exactly on the point, that it makes it safe for us to threaten countries throughout the world. It makes it safe for us to pursue our own new nuclear warheads and new nuclear plans.
Right, that's my next question. What are these hybrid warheads they're talking about?
Doesn't that sound nice, hybrid warheads?
Oh, yeah, it pollutes less.
Right, exactly.
Saves on gas.
Right. It's called the Reliable Replacement Warhead. And this is a scheme by which early in his administration, President Bush sat down with President Putin, and they made an agreement to reduce the number of warheads, nuclear warheads, that each nation has, moving from about 10,000 warheads to about 2,000 warheads. That's a huge, huge disarmament, really,
mm-hmm.
If it moves forward. There are a lot of problems with the agreement signed by the two leaders. First and foremost, among the problems was the fact that there was no timetable. Right, by 2012, we will reduce nuclear weapons by this much. There's no timetable by which, okay, by 2004 we would do this, by 2008. So we could come all the way up to 2012 and not have reduced at all. But under the cover of this plan, the United States is disarming, but what it's doing is putting more powerful warheads in fewer missiles. So we are reducing the number of warheads that we have, but we are increasing the potency and the lethality of the warheads that we hold on to.
Now, what kind of tonnage are we talking about? Do you know?
I don't have those figures in front of me, but we're talking effectively about thousands of Hiroshimas.
Right. I mean, they've already had hydrogen bombs that are in the megatons.
Right.
Which is a city killer, right? You could kill Houston with one of those.
Right, right. So so this reliable replacement warhead, Los Alamos Lab and Lawrence Livermore Lab have been in a competition. These are the two cornerstones of the United States nuclear infrastructure, the science, the place where the science of nuclearism takes place. They've been in a competition to come up with a new design for a new warhead. Many, even in Congress, have said this whole scheme, you know, is about projecting nuclear power abroad, but it's also essentially a welfare program for PhDs.
As is really the whole defense budget is really just welfare for billionaires, isn't it?
Right, exactly. And we can certainly talk about how much of this is basically just to keep all of these corporations that have extraordinary political power, keep their stock options high, keep their CEOs in million-dollar, multi-million-dollar salaries every year. But these two national laboratories are in this competition, and then at the end of the competition, the Nuclear National Security Administration decided, we can't really choose between these two warheads. They're both so great. Let's just move ahead with a hybrid of the two ideas that allows for continued and increased funding coming from the Department of Energy to both of these installations.
You know, I think an interesting interview that ought to be arranged some point in the future is kind of a side note here, is just the nationalization of all science in the country, where if you're a real math and science inclined person, you basically can't get work unless you're working for the state or for a private contractor that's making weapons for the state. What else is there? Unless you're, you know, into making medicines or something.
Right, yeah. You essentially are working for one of these laboratories, or you're working for a military contractor that's contracting with one of these laboratories.
Mm-hmm.
And that's striking. I mean, it would be interesting to talk more about that. It's striking given the huge scientific problems that our country and our world faces right now, whether it's the need for sustainable and renewable energy sources, for cures for diseases, for all of the problems that we face today are really going to be solved by people like me with liberal arts bachelor's degrees. They're going to be solved by people who understand physics and understand engineering.
Yeah.
All of those minds are occupied basically coming up with better and better ways to destroy the planet instead of solutions.
You mentioned at the top of the show about how they're basically taking all this money and just dropping it in a hole, and that's actually kind of a paraphrase straight out of 1984 by George Orwell, that's why they were building the floating fortress, was so that the people couldn't keep their own money and spend it bettering themselves, so that everybody would always be, you know, living paycheck to paycheck and not have time to sit down and read a book and do some serious thinking about the way things are. Just take that money and dump it into the ocean, is the way Orwell said it.
Well, that certainly describes the situation that many Americans and more Americans every day find themselves in.
Well, the best example out of your article, I mean, this story to me is just incredible. They're so neato on Weekday Wings and what have you on the Discovery Channel, but the F-22 Raptor, and then now it's already being replaced by the F-35? What do we need the F-35 for if we already have the F-22, Frida?
Well, because we're already planning to sell the F-22 to allies who may in the future become adversaries, and so we need to retain an even more advanced fighter plane.
So we needed the F-22 because they already have our F-16s.
Right.
But now that they're going to have our F-22s, we need F-35s.
You put your finger on it. So this is the logic, right? It's the logic of built-in obsolescence. It's the logic of constantly finding new markets for our weapons. And it's the logic that there was always something better around the corner, and that because it's there and because we can conceive of it and because we can craft it out of polymer, it should be built and fielded and be flying the skies as soon as possible.
Yeah, and I think you say in your article that the F-22 was designed in the late 80s to fight the Soviet MiGs of the 21st century that don't even exist.
Right.
It's only to fight our old planes, our old planes.
Right. And you think about the threats that are facing U.S. troops on the ground today, and no matter what you think about the war in Iraq and what position you take on it, there's no argument under which there's no way you can make an argument that the F-22 or the F-35 is helpful in winning the war in Iraq. Those are not the tools that are needed by troops on the ground today.
Right. I mean, these kind of planes are basically for fighting against major powers, not occupying third world nations indefinitely.
Right. And there's not a single country in the world that's flying a plane that can engage the United States in the way that weapons designers are imagining we will be engaged in the future.
See, this was my understanding, that basically a flight of F-15 Eagles can kill anybody in the world. Forget about it. And so if nobody can even come up against the F-15, then why even bother with any of this, except, again, to give welfare checks to big, fat, rich people?
Exactly.
I mean, and now maybe when they said on the Discovery Channel that the F-15 Eagle can beat anybody, that maybe that was just, you know, military-industrial complex propaganda, too. I guess I couldn't discount that.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of these systems have enduring problems that that the American public doesn't hear about because the corporations want to keep all of this under wraps. I mean, there are a number of retired generals who have looked through the U.S. military budget and identified $50, $60, $70 billion worth of cuts that could be made tomorrow just on systems that are unnecessary, already obsolete, made for threats that don't exist or don't work and don't do what they say that they're going to do.
Now, how many F-14 Tomcats did they just throw in the garbage just a few months back, right?
They threw them in the garbage?
Yeah, they canceled. That was my understanding, was they completely canceled the F-14 and retired it.
Huh.
And this is a plane that worked perfectly good for 30 years.
Right. And that's to make room for the new planes that are coming off the assembly line now.
Yep. Incredible. Now, we gotta skip straight to the Death Star now. You write in your article about the BX bomber, the rods from God. What's this? Near space? They dropping bombs on you from space? Is that it?
Right. So the rods from God are a mystical-sounding system that promised to strike ground targets anywhere in the world in a very, very short period of time. So this is sort of cutting-edge technology that projects a future in which not only will we be fighting wars on the ground, fighting wars from the air and from the sea, but also projecting power in a profound and lethal way from space. This is also envisioning future wars where people are sort of out of the equation. At least people on our side are out of the equation, and it dovetails with this future combat system which the Army is pursuing, in which billions and billions of dollars is being invested in right now, which basically removes U.S. soldiers from battlefields and through high-tech communication system allows them to basically be where they're not. And we're already seeing some of this technology being used in Iraq and Afghanistan with Predator drones, which are armed, unmanned aircrafts that hover over areas, relay images back to Colorado, back to California, and then technicians sitting at computers sending the message to fire missiles.
Well, and these drones have even been deployed over the Texas border with Mexico, haven't they?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Already being used against us.
Right, and you know, I mean, these systems are no more infallible than human beings on the ground, and in fact, more mistakes can be made, more innocent people can be killed, and the whole discussion over what war means and what war costs is obscured and obfuscated and sort of sidetracked because. Troops, U.S. troops, would no longer be involved, and so we can project power with greater and greater levels of impunity,
mm-hmm.
And that's really what all of these systems, when you add them all up, that's what they really mean is being able to project power without consequence and without cost. In at least human cost and political cost.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, you talk about all this stuff is so fancy and high-tech and, you know, straight out of a Terminator movie or something. But meanwhile, my neighbors are right now patrolling Iraq in aluminum Humvees.
Right, that's the other side of all of this, right? That that there are more than 100,000 soldiers in Iraq. Sometimes they don't have enough food. They're not getting their mail. Their parents are holding bake sales and garage sales in order to buy them body armor off the internet. And yet we're sort of the military of the future. And we're being killed in Iraq by, you know, TNT wrapped in a couple wires activated by a cell phone, right? Like it's a $15, $30 bomb. That's destroying some of these tens and tens, hundreds of thousand dollar systems.
It makes me wonder what a actual national defense would cost. What do you think, $10, $20 billion a year, something like that?
Well, there's been some great work done by a woman named Cindy Williams at MIT and a number of other people working in peace and security that put together a unified budget for national security. And
really? How interesting.
Yeah, and envision security and national security not just as military security, but as functioning public health systems, functioning police and intelligence systems.
I'm not so sure I want that.
And they estimate that for about $150 billion a year, with this comprehensive definition of national security, we can be a secure nation that can respond to threats that that emerge and actually threaten the United States, and then we can also respond to threats that are not enemy nations, but are some of the threats that we're going to be dealing with in the future: pandemics, flus. Food contamination.
Mm-hmm. And they say that'll be $150 billion a year. How much are we spending now?
Well, right now, today, we're spending about $500 billion.
And that doesn't include the wars, right? That's just the basic military expenditures.
The basic military expenditures. And then what President Bush and his administration have come up with a very smart and insidious plan to have all of the costs of the war and the wars, because we're talking about Iraq, we're talking about Afghanistan, we're talking about this nebulous, ill-defined war on terrorism, that all of that spending comes in what are called emergency supplementals. And those go through Congress a couple times a year, once or twice a year. They're $75 billion or $120 billion. And because they're for the troops, there's no debate. There's no dissension. These bills are rammed through, and they're full of pork and special projects and things that have nothing to do by any argument that you could possibly conceive of, anything to do with fighting the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. For example, in the most recent supplemental, there was money for the Joint Strike Fighter, right, which has, you know, which won't
right.
even be off the assembly line for a number of more years.
Yeah, I'm sorry, we're just going to have to cut it there. Everybody, Frieda Berrigan, she's the Senior Research Associate at the World Policy Institute, And you can check her out. She co-wrote an article with Tom Englehart that ran just last week at antiwar.com. Thank you so much for your time today.
Good to talk to you, Scott.
Well, everybody, unfortunately, I'm unable to get a hold of my second guest for today, Charles Featherstone from lewrockwell.com. Probably time zone difficulties, I'm guessing, but hopefully we'll be able to get him on later on in the week. I'm going to go ahead and just play some music for the rest of the hour for you guys. So thanks, everybody, for listening. This is Anti-War Radio for Radio Chaos 92.7, 95.9 in Austin, Texas. And be sure to check out the archive at antiwar.com.